questions about anything. Nothing. Well, that's good. Who's almost done their paper? Seeing if anyone actually hit up.
Gone, gung ho, but that's okay. All right.
When is the due date? That's a good question. When is it?
April?
Toward April? April 20 something? 26, 25? Last Friday in April. It seems so far off, doesn't it? It's going to get here. Yeah, I know. It's going to get here so quick. That's what I mean. Exactly. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And of course, that will be dropped in Engage. You don't send any copies. It goes into Engage. And it gets scanned for plagiarism. Any other questions? All right.
Professor, I want to present it in class, and I'm just supposed to submit it on Engage.
You're just going to submit it in Engage. All right, so 100 Years' War. Long, complicated event. I mean, heck, it took us 100 years just to get to it. Think about that. 100 years of different little things slowly building, leading up to it, before the war itself even broke out. Ultimately, it was caused by a claim by Edward III, who believed, because he was the grandson of Philip IV, he should have been king of France and not his, well, second cousin, Philip VI. But of course, what ultimately pushed Edward to go that far was a war in Scotland in which both the English and the French were meddling. So when Philip VI, the king of France, his forces started attacking locations along the English coast, Edward basically said, you know something, I'm going to declare war. But here's the amazing thing. Even though war was declared on May 27, 1337, it would be almost 3 years before the first battle took place. Again, one of the things that we think of when we think of wars is like nonstop combat. That was not the case back then. It was more like a state of war. And sometimes, even during wars, there was no actual battles. There would be battles, though, in the Hundred Years' War. Now, as I said last class, the easiest way to remember what the Hundred Years was all about is recognize the fact that, to a degree, it's kind of 3 years in one, with 2 years of peace in between. But here's an interesting factoid. In terms of death and violence and destruction, the first mini war was the most destructive. The first mini war saw the largest death tolls. Because what happened in the 1340s, in the midst of this war? The Black Plague erupted. So think of that. On top of everything else, death came. And death took everyone. In fact, it got so bad, it forced England to actually retreat from France in the 1350s. So they tried slugging it out, but ultimately, no one could stop the dance of death. Now, for those of you keeping score at home, the first technical battle of sorts was actually, interestingly enough, a naval battle. But it wasn't like a naval battle, again, like you think of naval battles, where you have the ships engaged in the maneuvering. No, actually, the French attempted to fight in Roman naval style, where you take all the ships, go back, you take all the ships, and you lash them together, and you have the soldiers climb on board and fight on a boat as if they were on land. But England refused to engage, and instead they relied upon their longbow to pick the French guys off the deck, and of course fire arrows. It would set the boats on fire. In the end, it was catastrophic for the French. 16,000 soldiers were killed in action. Of course, a lot of the death was because 24 of the French ships were sunk. But by destroying the fleet, that ultimately allowed the English to control the channel, and thus they could begin making their landing. The first land battle is also famous. It's the Battle of Crécy, located up here in the northern regions of France today. Crécy itself was a small village, and it was a battle based on maneuvering. So you didn't just march headlong at the enemy. You tried outflanking them. Well, Edward, he had 15,000 men with him to Philip's 25,000. And ultimately, Edward mastered the terrain. Not that you need to remember this many details, but I'm a dork and I'm interested in this kind of stuff. But the couple of you that are doing a 100 Years' War could potentially do a battle. So what ends up happening is very simple. You have the village of Crécy and you have a river. The bulk of England's men-at-arms, infantry, were positioned here in between the river and the village. And this was uphill. In order for the French to dislodge them, they had to march upwards. Now, unbeknownst to the French, the English also had a whole bunch of longbowers. So they used the archers to guard their flanks. So as the heavy armored French are slogging up the hill, it allowed the English to rain down death. Last little detail I'm going to share. Mother Nature also helped out, because during the midst of the battle, a rainstorm erupted. So on top of wearing 50, 60 pounds of heavy plate armor, the French had to march literally through the mud. In some instances, the English had prepared the battlefield, so the soldiers are sinking knee deep, which of course means they're pretty much immobile and they're easy targets for the archers. In the end, Philip himself was injured in the battle and had to retreat. And it was completely lopsided. Over 4,000 French soldiers were killed, a third of which were nobles, the actual leaders. But this marked the beginning, and what the French began slowly doing is having to pull back and giving the English ground. And they essentially started asserting themselves, locking themselves in. It would be another decade before the second major battle of the Hundred Years' War took place. And that was the Battle of Pontiers in southern France. By this point, Philip VI had died, and he was succeeded by his son John. And Edward III was getting on in years. So commanding the English troops was his son, the infamous Edward, the Black Prince. What happened in this battle? This was more of a field pitch battle. The Black Prince was slowly marching north, trying to, what the heck did I do? Trying to gain for himself more and more lands. He also took his army and divided it, split it into three separate units. And they marched in a column 40 miles wide, causing death and destruction. They sacked towns, they seized several castles, and everywhere they went, the French population fled. At the very same time Edward is causing havoc down here, John is up in Normandy, laying siege to another city. But for some reason, he initially refused to go challenge the Black Prince because he felt it would be dishonorable to abandon a siege, mid-siege. So in the end, John broke the siege by paying a huge bribe to the soldiers inside. Again, battles weren't necessarily won because of good tactics. Sometimes money came had to play. So what would you do for a bag full of gold? Would you betray your leaders? Well, the Norman soldiers did. And that would allow him to turn and march south to go battle against the Black Prince. Now at Pontiers, a similar situation occurred in that they were close to a town. Edward had mapped out the terrain. He picked a position on the top of a hill. And the English once again dug pits, dug trenches, barricades, fortifying their position. And then he waited. And he goaded John. He harassed him. John wanted to negotiate. But Edward refused and made the king look like a fool. So in the end, John, desperate, launched an attack. But John made a huge mistake. He only came with his cavalry. He sent his infantry home. So he believed he could roll over them in the knights, with the knights in their heavy plate armor and their lances and the war horses. But once again, because the English had picked the terrain, the horses were useless because it was a thickly wooded hill to get up. So they had to dismount and once again trudge up a hill. The English managed to hold off 4 assaults. On the 4th one, John personally led his soldiers, trying to rally a victory in the end. But once again, through the use of archery, Edward sent archers out, they flanked the French, and they rained in death from behind. At the Battle of Pontiers, over 9,000 French soldiers were killed. But the best part was, John himself was captured. And he became a prisoner of war. Because he was king, you didn't kill him. But instead, what you do is you brought him back to London. And he was held a prisoner of war for multiple years, in which the English tried negotiating a ransom. Now, as it turns out, King Edward III and King John did reach a settlement. That's known as the Treaty of London, 1359. Under this treaty, Edward would not only secure Aquitaine in Gascony, but he would also be restored Normandy, Brittany, and Anjou. All of the lands that were lost were to be given back. But the problem is the French nobles refused to give their consent. And they allowed the king to remain a prisoner. Bless you. In response, the Black Prince came back, landed in Calais, and began causing havoc in the north. But the French never sent an army. For 6 months, he ran rampant in the north. Unstopped, unchecked, killing peasants, harassing villages, looting, pillaging, raping. But in the end, he attempted to, I can't get the dot to work today, lay siege to the city of Reims, which is located north here of Paris. I'm surprised I don't have it right about there.
That's pretty good.
Bless you. But the Black Prince soon exhausted all his supplies, and he had to go back to England. To make matters worse, for 30 years, the French economy shattered because of all of the destruction caused by the English. And simultaneously, the English economy is shattered because they're having to spend and spend and spend to pay for these soldiers. In the end, they negotiated a new treaty with the Dauphin, the Prince, John II's son. This is the Treaty of Brittany. Under the terms, Edward, the prince, not his father, would be named Lord of Aquitaine, essentially allowing him to become king of the territory. And the amount of money the English demanded was lowered. The French agreed. Edward went back down to Aquitaine, took possession of his lands, and the state of war suddenly ended. For nearly the next 10 years, there was a peace between both sides. John stayed as a prisoner in the Tower of London for many years, but he was granted royal privileges, so he was actually able to leave the tower, and he could freely walk around London. When the Treaty of Brittany was signed, John would actually go home to raise the money, and he would swap places with his second son, Louis, who would be held captive until the king raised the funds. Unfortunately, when John came back and he discovered his economy was ruined, he was unable to actually raise the ransom. So he willingly went back to London and subjected himself once again to captivity, where in the end he would die of old age. Prince Charles would become king, and everything seemed to be working fine. Funds. Charles becomes crowned king. But he's not paying attention to the Black Prince.
Because there's actually a war that erupts in Spain. Because the Spanish are engaged in the Reconquista.
So it seems like the war's over. I mean, you had two major battles. You had lands being exchanged. No big deal.
Even the Black Prince wasn't interested in launching more strikes on France. Part of the reasons why is the people in Aquitaine were taking issue with the Black Prince over high taxes.
So neither side had any interest in starting the war again. In their minds, they thought it was done. Unfortunately, nothing lasts forever. And just as silly as what started the war was, what started the second mini war was even sillier. But before I go, any questions?
So when the Black Prince died, what happened to his son?
Hmm?
What happened to his son, the Black Prince's son?
The Black Prince's son?
Yeah, because you know that when he wants to come and raise funds, he have to give his son to replace him. After that, he returned and his son is released. So what happened to his son?
Oh, you mean Louis?
Yeah, Louis.
Louis would end up going back to France when John
back.
Went to London, back to London, yeah. But John ended up dying in captivity.
Yeah.
So his oldest son, Charles, had become king. Louis never became king. All right. Unfortunately, this is the only way I can get through it. I know it's a lot of silly details, and I know I'm just talking. And the book kind of covers it the same way. I'm not going to expect you to know all the nitty-gritty. I'm just trying to get through the narrative. The biggest thing to remember... First mini war, two battles, typical of the battles that were fought in the day. It was won because of positioning and terrain and fluke weather stuff. There was a settlement. It seemed like the war was over. Everything was going fine. The both sides were worried about their own stuff. That was until 1369. Now, under the Treaty of Brittany, the Black Prince was Lord of Aquitaine, and he was not required to pay homage. So he didn't have to go to Paris and bow down, take a knee before the king. But because of his tax policy, Charles V is King of France, was receiving complaints about what a brutal man the Black Prince was. So in 1369, Charles, as king, calls his lord, the Black Prince, to travel to Paris to answer questions. But the Black Prince refuses to go. Now, when a lord disobeys his king, in certain instances, that could be considered what?
Treason.
So, when Edward, the Black Prince, refused to go to Paris, Charles V basically declares war on Aquitaine. But Edward never was able to organize his troops enough to be able to march out of Aquitaine and take territory. Because there was a virtual uprising. So he would end up spending much of the last few years of his life dealing with the chaos that he created in his own domain. And in the end, he would get dysentery. He would return to England, but then he would die in 1376.
So the Black Prince is not John. John is the Black Prince, right?
No. Edward.
Edward is the Black Prince.
Yes. Edward the Black Prince is the son of King Edward III, who's still alive at this point, by the way. So the Black Prince is an English prince. But on the French side, we've already gone through Philip VI, who died, John II, who died, and now we're on the third king, Charles V. All right. As far as the second mini war, there were no big battles. And it was more chaotic. Part of the reason why was throughout most of France, sections of it, it seemingly was just like revolution or revolts or riots. To make matters worse, because the Black Prince had been the supreme commander for so long, none of the other English nobles were his equal. So when he died, there was no one to step into his shoes. His father couldn't do it because at this point, his father's in his 60s. And as the next click shows, there it is, hold on. Thought it was coming, I guess I'm getting ahead of myself, so I'll scale it back. At some point, there's going to be a click that's going to show that Edward dies, but we're not quite there yet. But in all the chaos, this essentially allowed the French to focus on going town by town, crushing the rebellions and taking the towns back into French possession. And ultimately, that's what Charles V did. With very few actual troops, he was able to reclaim almost all of Brittany, which had broke away in rebellion. He also managed to take a huge chunk out of Gascony. At the same time, England, their king, Edward, who started it all 40 years before, finally dies. But when he dies, the crown has to go to his grandson, the son of Edward. Richard II, who at the time was only 10 years old. So the war becomes completely lopsided. The only one who's actually fighting are the French, and the French are simply winning by default. In England, this peasant uprisings over taxes, Scotland rebels, Ireland rebels, the same problems that England always has to deal with. But long story short, it doesn't allow the English to actually focus on France, focus on fighting. So, by the end of the Second Mini War, Charles manages to take almost everything, except for a few fortified positions. Well, while this is going on, as we're going to see, there was a huge international crisis that erupted. An event known as the Great Schism. There would be a point where there was a king in France, at Avignon, and there was a king, pope, over in Rome. So no one is really paying attention to what's going on in France. And it, once again, it seemed as if the war was over. But in the midst of it, King Charles V would die, and he would be succeeded by his own 11-year-old son, who would be crowned Charles VI. So now we have a kid in England, a kid in France. And nobody has any desires to fight. And why did it take so long to settle? Well, for the next decade, there were revolts that were going on. And there were proxy wars. What's a proxy war? Anybody know? Proxy war is when two nations get involved in another war, but they support opposite sides. So to a degree, what's going on in the Ukraine is a proxy war, because China is supporting Russia, and we're supporting the Ukraine. China wants the Russians to win, because if the Russians win, that means our side and us, by default, loses. So there's no Chinese soldiers there. There's no American soldiers there. But we're on opposite sides. We're using our resources, and we're essentially duking it out. Well, the same thing occurred, mostly in Spain. The French supported one side, the English supported the other. And so technically, the soldiers that they're paying for are fighting, but their soldiers are not actually involved. So, because they're not actually fighting, amazingly, both the English and the French nobles are saying, "Why the heck are we fighting?" So the nobles, who were actually at this point running the country, sit down and they manage to hammer out a truce. Neither London nor Paris is interested in fighting one another. And both sides agree they're going to pull out of the proxy wars. They're going to try to allow an actual peace to take root. But unfortunately, even the second piece was a mess. More of a mess than the first piece, because neither side was able to enjoy the peace. In England, there's a revolution. King Richard II is deposed, pulled off the throne. And he's replaced by his nephew, who is crowned Henry IV. Poor Richard himself would be starved to death in captivity in 1400.
Where was Richard II disposed? Because he was crowned earlier, but he was a king. So where was the nephew to replace him? Is he not the one that is supposed to be the king, like the rightful heir to the throne?
No, we're going father to son, although Henry is a nephew of Richard.
Okay.
technically. Richard was son of the Black Prince.
Yeah. So when the Black Prince died, Richard is supposed to replace the...
Right, but the problem is the Black Prince died a year before Edward III. So Richard couldn't become king until Edward III was dead. But when Edward III died, it passed to Richard. But Richard was not an effective king, and he was overthrown and replaced by Henry the IV. I before V is 4. But like I said, we're not going to get caught bogged down on the details. We're just skimming to get to the final war, because the final war is the most important part. But we're going to get there. So I don't really have much to say about the reign of Henry the IV, because the reign of Henry the IV was turbulent. Peasant uprisings continued, plus the Welsh, or in Wales, they rebelled. And in France, France wasn't much better. Charles VI, he literally went insane. He completely lost his mind, which resulted in regents taking over. Until, I mean, he didn't die. Poor guy didn't die until 1422. But he was basically king in name only. So in all of this chaos, why did the war start again? Because England is dealing with English issues, and France has a mad king. Who in their right mind would want to start another war? Well, very simple. By 1413, things in England are starting to settle down. Because out of the chaos in England, one of the most effective kings since Edward III appears. In 1413, Henry IV dies, and he's succeeded by his son, Henry V. Henry V emerged as an effective war leader. He personally defeated the Welsh. He personally crushed many of the peasant revolts in the name of his father. He successfully invaded Scotland, causing the Scots to settle down. And ultimately, it would Henry V, who now, after 80 years, suddenly decides, you know something? I have a legitimate claim to the throne in Paris. The French king is insane. I should be king of France. So out of nowhere, 1415, he builds together an army and he invades, thus triggering the final mini war. And it's during this third stage that two of the most famous battles out of all of the wars of the Middle Ages takes place. The first is the Battle of Agincourt, which took place in October 1415, up here, just south of Calais. By the way, the Battle of Agincourt continued to inspire. And if you look back and read some of the writings of George Washington, who was losing battle after battle, greatly outnumbered, he made references to the victory of Agincourt that was possible. if you believe. All right, just some quick details, and we can go on to the second big battle. English outnumbered again, 3-1. Most of the 8,000 soldiers that Henry brought with him were archers. He faced off against an army of 25,000 strong, 10,000 knights, 10,000 heavily armored infantrymen at arms. It was a completely lopsided battle. But, as I told you, Henry was an alpha male. He was a war leader. He, as Edward the Black Prince had done and Edward III had done in the other two major battles, he picked the location of the battle. He selected the site. He, once again, takes a position on a hill. Looking out on the hill is recently plowed fields. The fields are encircled by dense forests. So, had the ground been hard, all the French would have to do is simply ride their horses and charge. But because the fields had just been plowed, the ground was soft. He knew they couldn't charge through the woods on their horses. So he positions his men like a Roman or a Greek phalanx at the top of the hill. And he just waits there. The French strategy of cavalry charge was countered by the fact that the English raised dozens of sharpened spikes right in front of the English positions. So as the French tried to charge, they see this, they get off their horses, and they begin marching. And as it had happened before, they end up knee-deep in the mud, and the English unleash death from the sky. French would lose over 6,000 men at the Battle of Agincourt, including 120 of the most powerful French lords. They also took another 2,000 prisoners of war. But what makes it so lopsided is the English reportedly only lost 112. Huge victory, huge success, historic proportions. But here Henry makes a mistake. Had he raced from Agincourt, there was nothing standing in his way. He could have marched on Paris and taken the city with ease. But you know what he decides to do? He decides to play Julius Caesar. He orders most of his men in their boats sail back to England, and they hold a triumph, a parade, celebrating their victory. Now, he would eventually come back in 1417, and he would unlaunch his troops, and in time, he managed to conquer not only Normandy, not only Brittany, but he would also take possession of much of northern France. There was nothing the French could do.
aiding himself was an alliance he made with the powerful Duke of Burgundy, a French noble who figured, well, Henry's a better king, so let's make him the king of France. It appeared as if everything was going in Henry's favor. It was so lopsided that Charles VI, the mad king, was forced to sign a treaty. The Treaty of Troyes. The goal that Henry had was to forever end hostilities between England and France. Under the Treaty of Troyes, Charles VI would remain King of France. But Charles would have to disown his own son. Henry would then marry one of Charles's daughters, and under the terms of the treaty, the children of Henry and Princess Catherine would become heirs to the French throne. So Charles VI stays king, but Charles's son, illegitimate. Henry marries Charles's daughter, and any children they have are Charles VI's heirs. Of course, the greatest irony is under the terms of this treaty, and you go all the way back to when Edward III declared war, his claim to the French throne was not ignored, rejected, because it was to pass through a woman. Well, the same thing essentially happened with here. But like I said, Charles VI is mad, so he signed the treaty. Now, Charles declared his son to be illegitimate and married off his daughter to Henry. Don't try getting it all. I promise you, I'm not going to ask you any questions like that on the test. Like I said, this is the only way I got to get through it. Because it's complicated. But we're almost done. Alright, the only thing Henry needed to do to achieve a victory and forever end the hostility between England and France, he had one thing left he needed to do. He had to capture the Dauphin. He had to capture Charles VI's son. So, he took his army and he moved south in attempt to capture the prince. To confuse you, Charles, the prince, was sitting in the city of Meaux. Right there. Henry arrives, encircles the city, lays siege. But unfortunately, as is always happening during this time period, dysentery breaks out. And during the siege, Henry V died. Two months later, Charles VI died. But there was no issue because Henry V had a son. And he was crowned Henry VI. But Henry VI was only 9 months old. Now, under the Treaty of Troyes, the moment Charles dies, Henry is going to become King of France. So the war should be over. But the problem is the French nobles sit back and say, wait, what? We're going to take a 9-month-old English baby and give him the throne of France when we have an adult heir in the Dauphin who's French? So the French nobles take the treaty and rip it up. And the war continues. But there's one snag. And another famous person would appear as a result of the snag. Under French law, in order for the Dauphin to become crowned king and thus become Charles VII, by law, he has to travel to the ancient city of Reims and get crowned in the cathedral there. That has been the custom for hundreds of years. Every single monarch, going almost back to Charlemagne, was crowned in Reims. But the problem is Charles could not get to Reims because the English control Reims. So because of this technicality, the Dauphin is the de facto ruler of France, but he's not king. So to get there, the French essentially has to go on the offense. They have to begin seizing some of the major cities to open up a path to get to Reims. And in come the second major battle of the third mini war. Standing in Charles's path was the fortified city of Orléans. The English had it. The French took it. The English would attempt to get it back. And it's during the siege that something weird happened. So weird, it's worthy of note. A 17-year-old girl appears by the name of Joan. Joan, who came from the small village of Arc. Joan of Arc, 17-year-old peasant girl. Now, she had claimed, since the age of 13, to have been visited by actual angels. She claimed her first visions occurred when she was playing in her father's garden, when none other than the archangel, Saint Michael, appeared, who would later be joined by Saint Catherine the Martyr and Saint Margaret the Martyr. And they began telling her of her special destiny. They told her that with her help, the English will be driven out of France. And that she will take the Dauphin to Reims and be crowned. And then the moment Charles becomes king, the French victory will be at hand. It's destiny. Well, two problems. Problem number one goes again to the fact that she's a girl. And you know who didn't fight in wars back then? Girls. You know why? What did they fight with? How did they fight? Swords, axes, wearing 100-pound suits of armor. You needed a lot of physical strength to be able to fight in the battles back then. And because of biology, men, their bones are denser, their bodies carry more muscle per pound, they have larger lungs. Thus, they can take an 8-pound piece of steel and hack it at an enemy, maybe not for hours on end, but a lot longer than a woman could, and inflict more damage. And that's the most important part. Not saying that a girl couldn't do it, but a man could inflict more damage. Because the goal when you fought in these battles is you take one strike and you kill the guy and you move on to the next one. Unlike what Hollywood does. There's no time for duels. Duels equal death. So the fact that she emerges and she's like, I'm going to bring this victory, caused a lot of even the French to go back and like, yeah, come on now. Oh, plus she also claims to be speaking to angels. So let's just say she makes these claims and even the French don't believe it. But then something weird occurs. For some reason, the French actually take her to Chillon, where the Dauphin had set up his court. Now, according to legend, Joan had never seen the Dauphin before, let alone talk to him. So the Dauphin planned a little trick. Okay, she's really speaking to angels. What he does is he gets one of his courtiers to dress up in his clothes, and they put him on the throne. So she doesn't know any better. She walks in, and there's a guy sitting on a throne wearing fancy kingly type robes. But according to the legend, as Joan was walking through the crowd, she stopped, turned to her left, move some people aside, and pick the Dauphin out of the crowd. So this woman may be onto something. Then, in their conversations, she convinces the prince, Dauphin, Charles, to let her go to Orléans to take command, that she would break the siege. I'm sure Charles is sitting back, okay, that was really weird that she was able to figure out who I was, but if I let her go to Orléans, she's going to get killed, and then I don't have to worry about her again. Only when she arrived, she changed the game. She donned a white suit of armor, not plate mail, leather. She did not in fact carry a sword, but instead she carried a banner with a cross on it. And she began going through the French soldiers. And to a degree, she kind of emasculated them. Essentially saying, I'm not scared to face the English, and I'm a woman. I don't even have a weapon, but I'll go. Which, of course, caused the French to sit back and go, oh, we're not going to let a girl go. I mean, we'll go. It's fine. That's fine. And not only did she do that, she began, during the midst of the battle, ordering the Frenchmen to reposition themselves. And wherever they went, they managed to score an advantage. It was as if God was guiding her hand. Eventually, thanks to her decisions in the battle, the French were able to drive off the English. And continued to win. After they broke the English at Orléans, they continued to move towards Reims, driving the English out of town after town, all because of command decisions that Joan made. The soldiers were amazed. The highlight came in July of 1429, when she led French soldiers and they captured Reims, allowing the Dauphin to travel north and be crowned. She was there, she was present. But unfortunately, the good times quickly came to an end. Joan, for example, promised the Dauphin that she would capture Paris. But the English managed to smash the French army. And that caused Charles to start questioning Joan's abilities. She then attempted to lead an army into Burgundy to defeat the Duke's forces, to kind of sever the relationship between the English and the Burgundians. Unfortunately, she failed miserably. And in the retreat, they were forced, the French, to abandon all of their new wonder weapons that they began using. Cannon. At a huge cost. She continued to try to win favor of Charles, but unfortunately, failure after failure after failure began to set in. But her fate was determined on May 23rd, 1430, when, trying to lead another expedition into Burgundy, she was captured by the Burgundians, who then transferred her to the English, who put her on trial. She had two crimes levied against her. One, heresy. Heresy. She claimed, after all, she spoke to the angels. In Catholic tradition, the angels don't speak to individuals anymore. If the angels are going to speak to anyone, they're going to speak to the Pope. Or they're going to speak to a cardinal or a bishop, not a lowly peasant girl. So she's a heretic. She was also charged with another very important crime. She was dressing like a man. Which, under the sumptuary laws that we alluded to after the Black Death, was a big no-no. Girls are not supposed to wear pants. She tried defending herself,
But during the trial, she continued to contend that the angels spoke to her.
And she couldn't deny wearing pants. So in the end, she was found guilty. And you know what the English did? They burned her at the stake. And you know the best part of getting burned at the stake? When they tie you up and they set this bundle of sticks underneath you on fire, you don't burn all the way. Yeah, you die on the first go-around, but your hair burns, your skin burns, your muscle, your fat burns, but you still have skeletal remains. So you know what they then did? They built a second pile, and they burned you a second time, which then causes the marrow to begin heating up, so your bones begin to pop. But even then, it's not hot enough, and there's still chunks left. So you know what they do? They burn you a third time. And by the third burning, the chunks largely pop, and there's for the most part nothing but ash. And then they scoop up the ashes, and they don't want to let her become a martyr. Hell no. So the English takes her remains and dumps it into a river. And essentially erases her for all time.
But here's the funny thing. Well, there was never a holy site. So, you know, pilgrims could go and worship at the altar of the dead Joan. Her memory remained. And soon, French soldiers begin calling out her name when they go into battle. And slowly, beginning in the 430s, the war begins to completely shift in favor of France. Part of it was, of course, French expertise. But truth be told, part of it was the fact that the young king's advisors were corrupt. They were less interested in achieving victory if money could be made. Do you want to know something scary? Have you heard of the military-industrial complex? We actually have companies in the United States that want us to constantly be engaged in war because they make money off of war. But what's scary is how many of our senators, how many of our congressmen and women, and even the president of the United States own stock in these companies. So the United States does get involved in lots of wars, but we don't fight wars to win any war more. We fight wars to shoot bombs and bullets, which then have to be purchased again. And every single round that's fired is a cha-ching in the bank of some manufacturing company. And every cha-ching in the bank for that manufacturing company means their stock goes up and members of our government financially benefit.
Well, the people who were supposed to be helping the King of England win this war because of his family's traditional claim to the throne, they're not interested in winning. They just want there to be battles so that way they can make money. They take bribes, you name it. Corruption.
Well, while that's going on, Charles decides, I'm sick and tired of fighting this war that's been going on now for almost 100 years. So the French begin to win. 435, they take Paris. He retakes the throne. And from that central position, he begins centralizing his authority over the rest of the country. He begins hiring more soldiers, and he begins winning town by town. Oh.
And the French also started fighting a different type of warfare.
Appearing by the 1440s, the French begin purchasing devices at the time that were referred to as bombards, because you would bombard your enemy. But what they were different types of guns and firepower and cannon. By utilizing this technology, sieges suddenly became antiquated. You didn't have to encircle the city and starve them out. You could begin opening fire and literally blowing down the walls. But even worse was when the French would take the artillery and turn it on the enemy and open fire. And that takes us to the last battle. The last major battle of the Hundred Years' War took place on July 17th, 1453. The Battle of Castillon. Charles VII led his soldiers to lay siege to the town of Castillon, which was really the last position of strength that the English had by 1453. All the rest of it had flipped to France. In charge of the English forces was the commander John Talbot. He was entrusted in holding the city. But John Talbot tried fighting a battle like the battles that were fought 30 years before. You would take your army and you would try to march on the enemy's position. But unbeknownst to him, the king had made a fortified position that kind of looked like Charlie Brown's little stripe going across his shirt. And behind the earthworks were cannon. So as the English tried charging, the French opened fire. It was said that for every shot that was fired by the French, 6 English soldiers died. Because imagine a piece of lead the size of a cannon pin bowling ball flying at you at the speed of sound. Sure, you can have your 100 pounds of steel metal on there, but it's not going to stop that ball from going right through your chest, right through your head, blowing your entire shoulder off, your hip, your leg. In the end, 2 out of every 3 English soldiers died. And it was said the French only lost 6. In the end, the peace would be sewn, but not for another 20 years. One of the reasons why is technically the war continued, but the English weren't fighting anymore. It became a proxy war. But the final settlement would be reached, and this will be the last point because I know we're like out of time. When the then French king, Louis XI, signed an agreement with the then English king, Edward IV. This is the Treaty of Picardy. Under this treaty, Edward would renounce his claim to the French throne in exchange for an annual bribe. Every single year for the rest of his life,
France would pay Edward a chest of 50,000 gold coins. And that's how unceremoniously the Hundred Years' War came to an end. When even the king was bought off because of corruption. All right, sorry for going late. We're going to come back. I'm going to kind of just give you some last thoughts on the Hundred Years' War. Then we got a couple of other crises we're going to have to shift over to the church. And FYI, definitely going to have an exam next week. So if you've missed any classes, make sure you listen to the audio while the audio is posted. Get the outlines, get the notes, get ready. Again, like I told you, and I promise you, you're not going to have to know every last little detail. There's no other way to teach it unless I can take this little baby steps through. On the exams, all you're going to have to know the gist. So if you're getting the gist, you'll be fine. One last thought. Words from Peppermint Patty. The more I study, the more I realize how little I know. Words of wisdom right there. Have a wonderful weekend.